Hello, and welcome to episode 64 of Thaisi Books, news and views about Thaisi literature from the world over. I'm your host, Jenny Bart. Thank you for tuning in. In today's episode, we have Manu Pillai on Thaisi Craft Chat discussing his latest book, False Allies, India's Maharajas in the Age of Ravi Verma. In this conversation, we talked about de-romanticizing the past, spotlighting those who've been footnoted in history, and much more. Manu Pillai is the author of the award-winning The Ivory Throne, Chronicles of the House of Travancore, Rebel Sultans, The Deccan, From Khilji to Shivaji, and The Courtesan, the Mahatma, and the Italian Brahmin, Tales from Indian History. Formerly the Chief of Staff to Dr. Shashi Tharoor, MP, Pillai has worked at the House of Lords in Britain with Lord Curran Billamoria and with the BBC on their Incarnations History series, assisting Dr. Sunil Kilnani. For 3 years, Manu also wrote a weekly column for Mint Lounge. His work has been published in The Hindu, Open Magazine, The Times of India, Hindustan Times, The New Statesman, and other publications. He is an alumnus of Ferguson College, Pune, and is currently enrolled as a PhD candidate at King's College, London. False Allies, India's Maharajas in the Age of Ravi Verma, tracks the travels of the iconic painter Ravi Verma through five princely states, from the 1860s to the early 1900s, and uncovers a picture far removed from the cliches in which India's princes and Maharajas attract. The world is not of dancing girls, but of sedition, legal battles, the defiance of imperial dictates, and resistance. We meet Maharajas obsessed with industrialization and rulers who funded nationalists. These men were anything but pushovers for the Raj to manipulate. Outward deference aside, the princes, as Manu shows, forever tested the Raj, from denying white officials the right to wear shoes in their bars, to trying to surpass British administrative standards. Good governance became a spectacularly subversive act, by which Maharajas and the native statesmen assisting them refuted claims that Indians could not rule themselves. For decades, this made the princes heroes in the eyes of nationalists and anti-colonial thinkers, a facet of history we've forgotten or ignored. By refocusing attention on princely India, False Allies takes us on an unforgettable journey and reminds us that the Maharajas were serious political actors. On a personal note, I've followed Manu's work since I discovered his Mint Lounge column, which he wrote for 3 years. All his books and essays are well-researched and, as he elaborates in this interview, focus on those who've been footnoted in history. This latest book was not just a page-turner, but also an eye-opener for me. I was left wanting to read entire books about not just the major personalities here, but all of the minor ones too, because of his engrossing sketches of them all. And now, here's Manu Pillai.
Hi, Hi, Manu. Thank you for coming on the Desi Books, Desi Craft Chat podcast. Lovely to have you.
Thank you, Jenny. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. And we are here talking about your latest book, False Allies, which is amazing because it is, again, as most of your books are, history. But this one is a little different from some of your previous books, as I described in the introduction, because you've threaded it around the artist, Ravi Verma. And so yes. I want to start with that first. You know, why construct a book around Ravi Verma? It's a great literary device. I love that. I love how you've taken these seven people that he's painted, but you've also written another book about him, right? And you do say in the book that he was a prime witness to the doomed world of the Maharajas, and he created this visual archive of many of these people. But why him?
Well, you know, he was a very well-connected figure. In the 19th century, he was a society painter, much sought by, you know, the who's who of the time, whether it was people on the British side, as well as Indian grandees and princes. And I thought that made him valuable. He was, for instance, he goes to Udaipur and there's a talented painter there, somebody who studied at the Slade School of Art. But because he doesn't have Ravi Verma's standing socially, Ravi Verma came from a very upper class aristocratic background. The other chap was treated very much as an artisan rather than as an artist, which meant there was a difference in the way other artists were treated versus this gentleman. And he was an insider because he was not only descended from royalty himself, his ancestors used to be the Rajas of Bepor and Malabar, which is North Kerala, but he was also related to Maharajas himself. So his two sisters-in-law were the Maharanis of Travancore in the last few decades of the 19th century. And into the 20th century, the last Maharanis of Travancore were his own granddaughters. So he was connected to royalty directly through his bloodline, through marriage, through his own grandchildren. Plus, as somebody who came from that world, he was not just going to other princely courts to paint their rulers, but was often received very much as a social equal, given, where another artist would be paid his usual fees. In Ravi Verma's case, it was fees at a much higher scale, but also robes of honor, jewelry, even elephants on one occasion. So he was very much an equal in that world. He was very much at home in that world. His brother left diaries that give us insights into the workings of some of these darbars, how various rajas behaved, etc. And most importantly, I wanted to use him to thread the story, as you put it, partly because on the one hand, these princes were very conscious of how they projected themselves, and he was a critical figure in helping them project a certain kind of image that suggested their own modernity, but also their connection to tradition and their religion and so on. So that was one element. And the other element was that there were far too many princely states to choose from, the 562 as per the official number. And even if I were to pick just the 100 big states or the main states that deserve the term princely state, there were far too many. And I didn't want to arbitrarily choose a few myself. So I thought, let me just track his travels. Let me track his peregrinations. And you discover that, you know, one moment he's in Travancore, which is a highly bureaucratized state. Another moment he's in Tamil Nadu in Pudukkottai, which is ruled by robber caste kings. Then he goes off to Baroda, which is ruled by Marathas, but their subjects are Gujaratis. He goes to Rajputana, which is a completely different feudal kind of setting with Rajput rulers and tribal communities and so on. And of course, there's Mysore, which has its own internal diversity and a very distinct culture. So simply following him around gave me a rather eclectic grouping of princely states. And I was therefore spared having to select states myself and bring in my own bias. Instead, I chose the states he went to and decided to go into each state in some depth and detail. So he was useful in terms of clubbing states, but also useful because he was an insider and very much part of that world.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, that certainly came across as I read. And you know, what I thought was interesting was, so you were able to use Ravi Verma's own peregrinations, as you said, and kind of help group this selection of royal folks, and you looked at the period between the 1860s and the first decade of the 20th century. So basically, but in that time, that's a huge chunk of time, and he was probably active with a lot of Maharajas, and yet you were able to narrow down to these seven. So now that we understand how and why you picked him as the uniting force, but what about these particular seven? How did you choose them?
Well, for instance, I didn't choose Hyderabad partly because, well, I didn't want the book to become too long. This was already a 550-page book in print, and I didn't want it to get longer. But I also had an excuse, which was that, you know, I didn't choose the Nizam of Hyderabad because he never got a commission from Ravi. He never gave Ravi Varma a commission. Ravi Varma went there hoping very much that the Nizam would ask him to paint, give him an official commission, but the Nizam never did. And Ravi Varma, the portrait he tried to impress the Nizam with had to be sold to a private individual at a loss. So, you know, that was one reason why that particular prince was not included. But the others were also interesting characters that I was very intrigued by. You know, whether it was Sayajirao Gaikwad of Baroda, who Ravi Varma paints as a young man of 18 or 19 years, and who goes on to rule for decades and decades, dies a very old man in a wheelchair, but in that time encapsulates a kind of princely modernity, a very unique kind of resistance to the Raj, where on the face of it, he's a pillar of the empire, but in reality, he's you know, supporting revolutionaries, supporting the Congress party, saying things in speeches that the Raj does not like. So he was definitely a very, very interesting character. Even in the Travancore court, you know, the two Maharajas Ravi Varma painted or worked with over there, one of them ended up expelling him from court. Again, very interesting people. In the late 19th century, they picked up the English language because they realized that to survive under the British, you needed to firstly master their conceptual universe, their vocabulary, and their grammar book. And, you know, Ravi Varma paints these two men, again, fascinating characters. Everything about the way they dressed, for example, they would tone down their dress because they knew the British would turn them into these tropical exhibits that were supposed to look exotic, whereas they consciously dressed, underdressed, and sort of dressed down so that they would look more businesslike. They would look more like men in control and men who actually did a job, as opposed to simply sitting on thrones and looking pretty. So I was just intrigued by several of these figures, even the women in the book. Although this is one book where there aren't as many women as there are in my other books. Even so, the ones who are in the narrative are quite remarkable, whether it's Rani Janaki of Pudukkottai, who was this furiously, you know, impressive character, Ravi Varma's own sister-in-law, his own granddaughters. These are all women of personality. And it just seemed amazing to me how he seemed, I mean, because of this world he negotiated and worked in, there were so many interesting people whose life stories itself could be used to weave an interesting tale. And because I chose the states, the characters then fell into place. I didn't have to look too far to again, select certain characters over others. The main ones that he painted are all in the book.
Yeah, no, I mean, and there's two points you've mentioned there that I want to pick up on. And I'll start with the point about the women, because yeah, I was also fascinated. In fact, as I was reading, I was thinking, my goodness, I want a whole book about that particular, you know, that particular woman, because, you know, and it reminded me of something I've read or heard, I can't remember which, but Ruby Lal has said, yes, you know, when she was writing when she was getting ready to write about Nur Jahan, and somebody, some other historian, academic, you know, said to her, what are you going to write? Because there's not that much material about the women. Mm-hmm. And she says, well, it really just depends on how you read it.
Correct. You know? I agree. And it's entirely about how you look even at existing material. Yeah. You know, Ruby Lal, Ira Mukoti, they've mm-hmm. been writing about Mughal women. It's and you compare their work to earlier writers on Mughal history. It's just that because the earlier writers assumed their own sort of subconscious bias told them that these women had nothing important to do, the material was never looked at with the right gaze or perspective. Whereas now that we've trained ourselves, now that feminist scholarship has made a huge difference in the way we approach all history, we've started identifying women where earlier they seemed invisible, but they were actually there. They were actually present. Studies have shown, and you know, I hinted at this in my book as well, that the harem was not some place where women sort of lounged about, either looking completely unhappy and decked in jewels, etc., or sort of plotting and you know, surrounding themselves with not to use a politically incorrect word, so in quotes, eunuchs. You know, it wasn't that universe. It was a political institution.
Oh, for
they had
sure.
economic resources. They had the capacity to thwart political decisions. They had the capacity to lobby important people. Just because they were behind parda did not mean they had no agency. These were women of tremendous personality.
And well, I have and a fascinating figure in the book.
They were indeed very, very well educated, and more importantly, very aware of themselves as political actors. No matter how much the British tried to see them as women, therefore your space is the domestic space, they never bought into that. You know, they never cared for the white man's character certificates. They were more interested in how they defined themselves, which was as political actors, not just as people who were confined to a domestic sphere. From the outside, it may look like their world was domestic, but they themselves were political actors, and they knew it. And I think in my book, the best person who represents this is Jamna Bai of Baroda.
Jamna Bai,
amazing woman.
She's the one I was thinking when I read her. I was like, I want a whole book about her.
But sadly, there is one old 120 year old biography of her. It's in Marathi, and I read it. It's not quite a critical biography, as you can expect from, you know, publications from that time, but it's an interesting book, and I was able to find a lot of information about her that otherwise, you know, one wouldn't have found in any of the English sources.
And you're right, I think a lot of these, you know, I mean, I'm writing historical fiction right now about medieval Gujarat, and a lot of my sources are in Gujarati. Mm-hmm. The reason being that, you know, the Anglophone writing, besides what you've described right now, you know, the specific biases about, you know, discounting women, but also just, you know, they focused on very specific things about, you know, victories and wars and, you know, not happening with the women. So, I want to pick up on the second point that you made earlier about how, you know, these Maharajas, some of these royal folks were actually also practicing in a way their own brand of nationalism and resistance even, right, against the British. Yes. And, you know, you've mentioned several times in the book that, you know, and actually the book itself is an example of how we need to approach this history, this part of our history, in a more sophisticated way and understand it better than, you know, we've been taught in our schools, because there's a lot of gaps in our education. And I grew up in India, I went to school in India. So, you know, there were a lot of gaps, like there's a lot of stuff I read, both, you know, what I've read in your columns over the years, or in your other books and this book, that I'm like, you know, hey, we never learned about these things, right? It was pretty much glossed over. We would learn about ancient Indian civilization and the glories of that. We'd learn all the way up to maybe when the Mughals came, and then it was all about the bad Mughals, and then we jumped straight to the bad British, and then the nationalists were doing all the good work, and then we never heard about what was going on between them and the Maharajas. And you mentioned how, for example, there were some that even Gandhi was, admiring off. So these are things that we just didn't know. But what's interesting also is then that you start the book with a very controversial politician's quote as your epigraph.
Yes.
And so I would like to understand a bit more about that. I get that she was against royalty and feudalism, but tell us about the context of that quote and why you wanted to open the book with it.
Because in many ways, that quote by Indira Gandhi, which she made in 1967, where she says, it was during an election speech in Rajputana, in Rajasthan, I think, where she says, go ask your Maharajas what they did when the British were around, and how many wells they dug, and how many roads they built, and how many canals they constructed. And you'll find that the sum total of their contributions is zero. It's along those lines. It's not an exact, I'm not repeating the exact quote, but it's along those lines. And in many ways, I think to this day, that is the image that prevails of royal figures in India, and not helped by the fact that after independence, you know, once their privy purses were gone, most royal families and their descendants, they either set up museums or hotels and things, and they themselves in some ways began to promote, let's say, a more colorful image of themselves and what their legacy is. Whereas in reality, even if you were to look at the Maharajas just as political actors, and I think that's an important point, which is that we imagine them as just sitting in their palaces doing what they wanted, and everybody was getting oppressed, and the Raja was just this cruel figure. But in reality, they were political actors ruling over political spaces with other political groupings and sort of elements that they had to balance out. So for instance, a Raja never had arbitrary power. He had, of course, to negotiate with the British, who were on top of him, on top of his head. They were the ones putting pressure from above. in the court, as we discussed earlier, you know, the women of the palace, they had influence as well. And that was something to reckon with. There were other elements in court, other factions, groupings of noblemen, etc., even in the most feudal states, that exerted all kinds of influence and might even, you know, might even challenge the Raja. Then there were people beneath him, his bureaucracy that operated the state and might throw hurdles in his way or prevent him from fulfilling his personal desires and goals. There would be people, whether it was peasant groupings, whether it was religious minorities, whether it was even tribal groups. So it was, no Raja had arbitrary power, which is why I said they, you know, I argue in the book, they need to be looked at as political figures. And the interesting thing is that even in the colonial period, despite the fact that the British were their overlords, the 40% of the Indian subcontinent that they ruled was essentially Indian-ruled India. It was Indian rulers with Indian bureaucrats, Indian vassals and chieftains ruling over Indians, which means for any understanding of modern Indian history, it's tragic that we haven't looked at this 40% of India, because there are all kinds of things that would help us understand. There's a scholar called Ian Copeland, for instance, who's noted how episodes of violent communalism, which is, you know, a religious conflict between Hindus and Muslims, was lower in the princely states than it was in British-ruled India, which should provoke us to ask why. You know, why was it that under princely rule there was less rioting as compared to, you know, supposedly more enlightened British rule, supposedly more dispassionate British rule? What institutions enabled people to settle religious disputes in princely territories peacefully, as opposed to waiting till it actually flared up, as happened in British territory? So obviously these places, the princely states, were interesting spaces. I'm not arguing that the Rajas were good or bad. I'm not claiming that they need to be brought back. I'm not suggesting that they were all amazing, wonderful people. In fact, there were rotten eggs, as there are rotten eggs everywhere in all political classes. But what I am arguing is that the Rajas in the princely states were interesting, you know, people and interesting spaces, and therefore they deserve to be studied in some detail. As you referred earlier to Gandhi's, Mahatma Gandhi's, liking for several princes. In fact, in general, for the longest time, till the late 1930s and early 40s, he was quite respectful of all the Rajas, because he himself was born in a princely state. He came from a family that had a long history of service towards the local princes there in Kathiawar. So he understood them. Gandhi himself, as, you know, scholars on him have shown, was a fairly conservative man. He did not believe in anglicizing his vocabulary as far as nationalism was concerned. He did not mean to cut off the future Indian state from its very Indian roots and sort of westernizing everything in terms of the basic infrastructure and models and institutions we would build. So he was a man who saw something of value in the princes. So he respected the Maharaja of Mysore, called him a Raja Rishi and compared his kingdom to Ram Raja. He respected the Maharani of Travancore and various other princes. And the other thing is that the princes were for the longest time in the good books of the nationalists as well. The bad reputation they have, that Indira Gandhi quote you referred to, essentially comes out of what happened between the princes and the Congress Party in the late 1930s and the 1940s. Let's say in the last 15 or at most the last 20 years of British rule in India. Before that, for a good 50, 60, 70 years, the Rajas and the nationalists were more or less friends with each other. Because for the nationalists, looking at princely rule, looking at the big states and the better governed states, was one way of telling the British that your argument that natives can't govern themselves is rubbish. Because look here, in this princely state, this particular native ruler is ruling better than the British. He's got more money that he's spending on education, more money that he's spending on roads, canals, everything Indira Gandhi claims they didn't do. Early nationalists actually said the opposite. Mm. Other ways was that, you know, the princes had an interest in supporting the nationalists, because they too recognized a common enemy in the British. And just as they wanted to push off or minimize British interference in their states, they also had an incentive in supporting the nationalists, because the nationalists would keep the British busy and preoccupied in British India, thereby sparing princely India further stress and further pressure from the British and from above. So, yeah. You know, there's all kinds of interesting dynamics going on there. And that's the argument of the book, that it's interesting right. at the very least. And therefore, we need to study it.
Yeah, yeah. And as you say, you know, I mean, the sad thing is that the idea of these Maharajas, or at least the history, as complicated as it is, it was kind of reduced to this cartoonish image that became part of the popular imagination, right? You know, it's about the hunting and the women and the jostling for a place in the British court. And, you know, that's kind of the image we've been left with, even with, you know, if you think about Bollywood, for example, and how they portrayed, and I think of one of the most recent examples with the movie Lagan, for example, you know, I was thinking about that as I was reading. So, yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of that. And, you know, one thing that that I was thinking with all these intricate power plays and the subtle forms of resistance that you were describing in the book with each of these royals, the work that they were doing with you know, for their people and somehow pushing back to the British and still supporting the nationalists. And yet, after all that, they fell. Because either they didn't want to or couldn't keep up with the times. Do you see a possibility where if the strongest among them had united and they had all shifted gears, perhaps, do you see that there could have been a possibility for some deal with the newly formed government where they could have survived in some form, some alternate history, if you like, you know, because they were invited. You've described how they were invited to engage in the nationalist conferences and such. So do you see a possible alternate history here at all?
I think the answer goes back to the mid 30s, because there was something called the Federation Plan, which looked at India as a federation, a loosely governed federation, where the provinces would be there, the princely states would be there, and there would be central bodies and institutions to manage the whole thing. And the princes were a part of that equation. They were a part of that model that was being constructed or envisioned at any rate. The Congress did not like it because, you know, they obviously wanted greater, tighter central control and not loose provinces and all the Rajas being given this kind of importance in that legislative body and in the institutions that were planned. But the princes were happy to discuss it. In fact, they used this whole federation discussion to try and extract all kinds of concessions from the British before they actually signed the paper. By then, of course, the Second World War started and the federation plan did not go ahead. But if it had, we would actually have ended up perhaps in an India where there would have been princely states and there would have been provinces under Indian politicians with different kinds of political structures within. So you could easily see a system where instead of parliament as we have it now, there would have been a body where the princely states would send a certain number of people, the provinces would send a certain number of people, and they would legislate for all kinds of central policies for the entire, what we now call the Indian Union. Of course, World War II came in, partition became a much bigger issue. And with partition looming, the Congress Party and what remained to them of India, you know, they were very keen to make sure it would be a strong state, very strongly held from the center by the leaders of the Congress Party. They did not want to risk secessionist movements. They did not want to risk the country breaking up. And therefore, the center had to be extremely strong. And that is why it was important that the princely states not just accede as they did in 1947, but also merge with the Indian Union, as was done 2 years later, because they didn't want the Rajas in their states retaining that kind of identity. Anything that could potentially be used in future as an argument to either secede or break up the union. So that's one of the reasons why the Congress pushed essentially and, you know, eventually for the dissolution of the princely states. But even as late as the mid 1930s, all discussions around India's future did feature the Rajas' existence and their continued existence for the next God knows how many years and decades. The Rajas, you're right, did not lobby together. They were always handicapped by this, which was that the Nizam of Hyderabad was so hoity-toity that he would look down on all the other Rajas. Rajput Rajas would look down on Maratha rulers, even if the Maratha ruler politically was higher than any given Rajput Raja. Similarly, you know, they had all kinds of caste issues, regional issues. They would not see each other as equals. Everybody ultimately looked at his or her state purely as an individual entity, with good reason. They had no reason to believe that their states lacked legitimacy. They were legitimate political units. It's just that they never saw themselves as one class that should lobby together and ensure their survival. And by the time they woke up to it, it was either too late or, you know, the equations of power had changed in such a way that they simply didn't have room to maneuver and they didn't have any leverage. But yes, there was a time when, you know, even in the Congress Party did come close to accepting that, okay, we'll have to come to some kind of arrangement with princely India. We don't accept the arrangement the British are trying to make, but something will have to be done because you can't just get rid of them. And yeah. And what they signed, the papers they signed in 1947 were essentially treaties. They were essentially, you know, they most of the states essentially handed over just foreign policy, defense, and communications to the Indian Union and retained control on all other matters internally, which was basically what the equation they had even with the British. The British were replaced by the Indian Union. But as I said, 2 years later, that was upset completely, and they decided that we want full integration, and the Rajas would continue in some kind of ceremonial role. And of course, in due course, even that was diluted and eventually abolished.
Yeah, but you know, even as I read the book and even as you were talking now, one of the things that strikes me is even with the partition, what I remember the most, and I'm sure we probably read a bit more about it, but the thing is, I think what gets highlighted the most and reinforced the most in the partition, we only hear about the two royals who caused a bit of a ruckus, right? We hear about the Junagadh Maharaja, who decided he was going to be part of Pakistan, and then he was talked out of it, and Kashmir. And so we don't hear much about the contributions or the positions of all the others, even though there were so many. And, you know, I think of my home state, Gujarat, and I think it had hundreds of princely states.
It did.
Small and large. In fact, I think it was one of the states with the most, you know, one of the regions, or you know, yeah, with the most princely states, and there's so little known about them.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I mean, there's good reason why the Congress fell out with the Rajas, which is that by the mid-1930s, the British had made all kinds of concessions. So Indian politicians were in a position, they were actually being elected. They didn't have all the let's say, more important portfolios, so no finance, nothing to do with defense and all of that. But the education, health, you know, portfolios like that were being handed over to elected Indian politicians. You know, by the late 1930s, Congress itself was participating in elections under the new rules that the British had framed. They were forming provincial governments, and they had their ministers who were serving the government. So in that situation, naturally, subjects in the princely states also expected their rulers to move with the times and come up with various arrangements that would allow the people to have a share of power, even in the princely states. And this is where the princes proved reluctant. They had been autocrats. Even the best of them were benevolent despots, but they were in control for most part. And they were not keen to give away or share power with their people. Representative democracy, so long as it was contained within, you know, these councils and chambers that didn't really have teeth, and ultimately the Raja could veto, the Raja was willing to accept it. But the moment the conversation moved to a situation where the assembly might veto the Rajas obviously didn't want that. So by the late 1930s, you find in various states, Mysore, Travancore, Cochin, you know, all the other big states, you find people agitating for greater representation, and the Rajas slowly becoming more and more repressive, even in the best of states. And I think this is why by the time of independence, in the previous 10 odd years, most of these Rajas, even the better ones, had lost a great deal of sympathy. More importantly, forget sympathy, they had lost control of the narrative. So even in Mysore, where the Rajas were seen as extremely forward-thinking, you know, they were big industrializers and, you know, people who were very much right in front of the idea of progress, thinking that, look, this is how we want to be known as progressive rulers. Even they had lost sympathy because they were now picking fights with their own subjects and their own politicians. So this meant that the Rajas lost the narrative, they lost control over what was being said about them, and therefore they were villainized with good reason. As I said, for the last 15 odd years, they had become repressive and more autocratic. And you know, the result is that has tainted the rest of their legacy as well. It's tainted the fact that for much of the freedom struggle, they were actually seen as positive figures, and it was only in the last 15 odd years that they suddenly became the villains of the piece.
Yeah, you know, and you talk about that, obviously, and, you know, one of the things that surprised me, because I don't recall reading that anywhere, is that when the new Indian government did finally take over, they were quite, what's the word I'm looking for? They were quite forceful. For example, you describe, you know, what happened in Hyderabad, where they launched a full-scale invasion, including aerial bombing. And I don't recall reading that, but you know, you described how there was the, you know, the official report was suppressed. but that, you know, thousands of people were killed during this police action. And so that, to me, as I was reading, was like, whoa, that's, you know, I mean, there were a lot of whoa moments, things that I didn't know. So my question to you is, as you were researching and writing about each of these Maharajas, was there maybe one or two particular discoveries that surprised you the most? Because obviously you do a lot of research, you've been writing about this stuff for years, but was there anything that just like this thing took me by surprise, but then I'm not as deep into it as you are, but was there something that even shocked or surprised you?
I think the Hyderabad case is fascinating. Obviously, I don't cover it in any detail here, but it's quite remarkable that this is happening around the same time as partition, right? It's happening soon after partition. And the numbers, you know, people have estimated between 28 to 50,000 people, or is it 40,000 people? Either way, tens of thousands of people were killed. And it wasn't just the invasion. It wasn't just the fact that the Indian army came in and, you know, people were killed on the Hyderabad army side. It was the fact that there was communal violence thereafter. And I think the report indicates that, and I mean, the report's never been officially released. So what we have essentially is leaks and bits that were published without authorization. But it suggests that, for instance, because partition was so violent, Sikh soldiers who were part of the Indian army coming in took revenge on Muslim subjects of Hyderabad. So you have a communal situation that's unfolding. It's in some ways a continuation of what was happening because of partition. But in another sense, it's also another violent event that was part of the birthing of the Indian Republic. And yet we don't talk about it. It was muted. It was, you know, sort of buried under this term police operation rather than an invasion, because to call it an invasion would also mean accepting that the Nizam of Hyderabad had some kind of, some claim to political equality with the Indian government, which they didn't want to do. So they wanted to call it a police action. But it was, the numbers are just unbelievable. It's just tremendous. And there's a scholar called Sunil Purushottam who's been working on this. He published a book earlier this year, in which you can get some more details. But leaving the violence aside, I was also struck by, you know, the idea of, we often think that during the freedom struggle, people had a very clear notion of Indianness and foreignness. So the white British ruler is the foreigner and you are all Indians. Whereas in reality, you find that in the late 19th century, nationalism had to be very consciously and painstakingly constructed. It was not easy to persuade people to think of themselves as belonging to one unit or one identity. People had all kinds of differences, as they do even now in terms of languages, what they ate, and amusingly, even in bathing styles. I was quite amused by a memoir where a Maharashtrian woman goes to, I think, Punjab, and the women there are fascinated that she goes in for her bath with her sari, you know, draped around her. And they're like, is this how you bathe? And she said, yeah, where I come from, this is how we bathe. So, and it was just this wonder between both parties that, you know, wow, this is how you bathe in your part of the country. So people didn't think of themselves as Indians. It was very tough to construct that identity, which meant that these princely states often, when they imported Indian bureaucrats from elsewhere, so Travancore, Pudukkottai, Mysore, these South Indian states would import Maharashtrian Brahmins because it was a community of English-speaking Brahmins well-entrenched in the colonial bureaucracy, trained in the colonial bureaucracy, and therefore, by importing them into your princely states, you were able to build modern infrastructure, institutions, etc., and also use these high-caste Brahmins who spoke English as middlemen in your dealings with the British. But in their states, the subjects saw these people not as fellow Indians, but as foreigners. So in Travancore, you often hear this lament against the foreign Brahmin, the foreign Divans. And the word foreign is used without any irony, because to the local people in Travancore, a Maharashtrian Brahmin coming and ruling them was as foreign as suggesting an Englishman come and rule them. In Mysore, in fact, in the early 19th century, the Raja tried to minimize the influence of these, in quotes, foreign Brahmins, and they actually conspired with the British and ended up toppling him. This was Krishnaraja Thavadiyar III. He was toppled around 1830, after about 20 years on the throne. In this situation, you find a group of powerful Indians actually working with the British against an Indian prince. So it's quite intricate, it's quite convoluted, it's quite fascinating, and it makes you rethink many things you would imagine, about nationalism, many things we take for granted about the Indian identity. And it makes you understand that in reality, these were not a given. These were not something people at that time could take for granted. And they needed allies. They needed people to help them build a nationalistic narrative and slowly construct a sense of being part of of the same thing, being part of the same journey. And it takes till Gandhi comes in that this really becomes a political force. Till then, it's very much a work in progress, which was another thing that I found fascinating, that, you know, it's not something we're taught in our school books. We assume that 1857 rebellion, everybody attempted to push the British out by force. It failed. Therefore, they moved to constitutional means, and that was it. But right. In reality, no, it was a much more complex affair.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, we you're right. We're given that simplistic line that is drawn from 1857 to the Quit India movement. And it's not as straightforward as that, as you said. And, you know, to your point, the role that these royals played was, yes, controversial, yes, conflicting. And yes, sometimes they were acting against, in a way, if looking back now with hindsight, you know, in a way they were acting against their own interests because they were short-sighted. They weren't looking beyond their province or beyond their provincial mindset. But yeah, it's fascinating how, in terms of official historical record, we're not given all of this information. It's almost as if, well, it is in a way, you know, of course, there was a lot of nation building that was happening right after independence. And so part of the nation building, you know, agenda was how to educate us and keep that sense of nationalism brewing and, yeah. And so that we could build this country back up in a way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I it's difficult. I mean, you're right. There's no easy answers. Now, let me talk a little bit about the research that you did, because, you know, obviously, and I've been reading your work over the years, you do a lot of research, you have, you know, you're quite thorough in terms of going and looking at diverse sources beyond, thankfully, beyond the standard history texts that we have, which is why we read your work, because we know that you will bring us something new. And in this book also, you know, you've gone through many different sources. And I have a general question first, and then, you know, maybe you can make it specific with how you approached it for this book. But did you generally start with, okay, here's a topic I want to explore. You come up with your research method, a source list, or do you just say, okay, here's a topic and I'll research as I go along and fill in the gaps as needed? How do you organize that process for yourself?
I think it is, I do sort of, you know, do my research on the way rather than going in with a preset idea, partly because sometimes the material surprises you. Sometimes you find material in the strangest places, and going in with too rigid an attitude and too much of a plan can sometimes be a handicap. You know, what matters ultimately is how diverse your sources are. So the natural first step is to read up existing material on the subject and figure out where the gaps lie. In this case, you know, the gaps are massive. Therefore, it was great fun to work on this book. Although people have been working on the princely states since the 1970s, it's usually specific princely states. And even though it's been about 40, 50 years, the numbers are very few. You can count about 20 odd scholars who worked on it since the 1970s and produced scholarly texts, which means that there is a huge gap to fill. Then, of course, there's a question of diversity of sources. In this case, there's, of course, Ravi Varma's art, because the paintings are telling you something about how these Rajas wanted their political image to be perpetuated and how they wanted to be seen by people. Then there's the newspaper record, because a lot of what was happening in the states, a lot of what was happening in negotiations with the British was often recorded live in various newspapers. It could be nationalist newspapers, which were on the side of the princes. So, for instance, you know, there was a Maharaja of Kolhapur who was treated very badly in the early 1880s by the British. In fact, he was beaten to death by a white man. He was a young boy who they were trying to shape up into this manly ruler of their dreams and desires, and he simply would not bend, and he simply wouldn't become the person they were planning. I think he also was depressed and all of that. Eventually, the poor chap gets beaten to death. And naturally, that becomes a cause for nationalist newspapers. Similarly, there's the Anglo-Indian press, there's the British papers, there's papers like the Times of India. So the newspapers are an important source. Then there's the material left by some of these princes themselves. So Sayajirao Gaikwad's speeches are fascinating because he uses the word national government, nationalism, national culture. The word national is used far more than you would ever imagine an Indian prince who's technically an ally of the British to use. So speech was like that. Then private papers, their internal correspondence, letters, something like a royal tutor's personal diary. You know, the Maharaja of Travancore in the 1920s had a tutor who's left a 3-volume diary, which is fascinating because it tells you so much about the inner workings of the family in the palace, away from the eyes of their subjects. It's an Englishman's view of things. So naturally, there's a certain kind of prejudice, but all the same, it's interesting. So there's that kind of private material. Then there's archival sources. So the National Archives, I found some material at the National Library of Scotland, of course, the archives in London. All of these give you inner workings. Parliamentary papers, because often princely India and matters concerning the princes were discussed in the British Parliament as well. And sometimes politics in Britain would end up having interesting effects on princely politics in India. So there was that. Even the writings of the early nationalists, whether it's Dadabhai Nauroji, M.G. Ranade, Gokhale, all those big names of the late 19th century, early 20th century, all of their writings at some level or the other have engaged with what to do with the princely states and what exactly the future of the princely states would be. And they all saw a future for the princely states, even in post-colonial India. So Ranade saw it as the princes occupying and forming some kind of a House of Lords, and British-ruled India forming a kind of House of Commons. One of the first draft constitutions written in India was for a princely state by Sir T. Madhav Rao. And so even the papers of some of these figures from the late 19th century and how they engaged with the whole question of the princely states, that was another important source. So the sources are diverse, and the more diverse they are, the better, the more nuanced the picture is that you're able to construct, and the more honest in some ways that it can be. And, and of course, scholarly work that exists already on these states, on different facets of the states. Even something like the caricature of the princes, being obsessed with hunting. There's actually a PhD thesis. I forget the name of the scholar, but she's done this wonderful work on why the hunt was such an important thing, and how the Maharaja of Udaipur, for example, Fateh Singh, he would use the hunt as a means to flaunt his own masculinity and suggest to the British that they were not masculine enough. So the hunt isn't purely just about killing animals. It's also a platform for the ruler to flaunt a certain kind of masculine image to counter the British idea that the princes are all effeminate figures and they're not masculine enough. So there's politics happening even during the hunt.
They were definitely political power plays, for sure. I mean, yes. It was all about it was symbolic, right? It was all about showing, I mean, from the little that I've read, I haven't read as much as you have, but from the little scholarly work that I've read, I agree with you. I think there was so much about a hunt. Even in Gujarat, where after the Jain monks came and hunting and meat and all this was banned, and not banned, but, looked down upon and cast aside, but it was still a very political thing. So, yeah, I hear you on that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting for us to have that reading or that understanding now, despite what was missing, I guess, from our textbooks growing up. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me ask you. Yeah, well, and talking about the research, as you were describing, your process here and the different sources, one thing that I wonder, and I've always wondered, even as I've read your columns and books throughout the years, is if I was to ask you about the core connecting thread running through all your own historical writing so far, whether it's the columns or the books, but if you step back now and you say, this is the thing that connects all my particular interests in history. Because, I mean, for me, for example, I don't see history as, chronologically, it may be a long time ago, but I still think it tells us a lot about our present. It helps us see our present in a different way. So that's my own personal attraction to history and why I read it. What would be your thing? What is that core connecting thread for you?
I agree. History is important to making sense even of the present. In many ways, I read history and I study history partly because it de-romanticizes a lot of ideas we have about the country, about the nationalist narrative and so on. And I don't do it because of any political reason. It's just that it's interesting to look at things slightly more objectively instead of succumbing to the romance of grand narratives, and studying different things from different angles, new perspectives, essentially helps you get more objective. It makes this whole romantic narrative, whether it's nationalist narrative or anything else, you're able to question that better. You're able to peel back the layers better. But you know, going back to the first part of your question on what is one uniting thread, I think I pick stories that in some ways have been footnoted. And I don't, I mean, and I, this is a point I've been making a lot recently, because somebody asked me, why is it that you've done three books on some aspect or the other of royalty? Because my first book is on the last queens of Travancore, second book is on the sultans of the Deccans, the third is, of course, much more diverse, has all kinds of characters. And this is, again, about the princes. And it's interesting that the idea of marginalization is often seen from a class perspective, which is that, oh, they were the elites and therefore there's nothing much to study, there's nothing much left. And it's only the subaltern that deserves to be studied. But as I see it, marginalization happens different ways. The first book, for example, was centered on a queen, was centered certainly on a woman of privilege. But as a woman, she was footnoted. As a woman, she was marginalized on the basis of gender and reduced to a sort of small player, whereas in reality, she had played a much bigger role in politics in the 1920s and 30s. And I thought it was important to tell that story. Similarly, with the second book on the Deccan Sultans, this region that's called the Deccan, it's overwhelmingly about the Maratha powers, or it's about the invasion by the Mughals and their conflict with the Marathas. And we forget that for very many centuries, it was under the control of these fascinating sultans, some of them, you know, converted from of a line that was descended from a converted Brahmin, but were Shias and married African women and Persian women. Somebody else was originally from Iraq, but ended up marrying Telugu women and Teluguized themselves. There are fascinating stories there, but they've been marginalized under the Mughals and the Marathas. And I thought it was important to remind people that, hold on, there's this whole category of rulers in the Deccan in the early modern period who deserve to be studied. And the same with the princely states. Any general understanding of modern Indian history is so obsessed with British ruled India, which is 60% of the landmass of this country, it neglects the other 40%. And This is, I suppose, it's personal, because my grandmother grew up in a princely state. And hearing her talk about her childhood years, of course, they knew who Gandhi was and they knew who Nehru was, but it was not something that directly affected their lives. Their lives, you know, their ruler was the Maharaja, there was an efficient bureaucracy, the schools functioned, every cluster of villages had a school, there were medical services. So the kind of history I got from them was not one of people standing up and fighting the British. None of that was happening in their lives. And I think it's important to recognize and acknowledge that and give some space, if not a lot of space, at least the 40% of the narrative that it deserves, even by virtue of its geographical size. So it's important, I think, the princely states are important to me for that reason, which is that, again, it's a part or an aspect of modern Indian history that has been marginalized because the nationalist narrative took over, with good reason. As you said earlier, after independence, simply keeping the country together required some kind of unifying nationalist narrative. But I think 70 years after independence, we can more maturely revisit the past and look at some of the more neglected aspects of Indian history as well. So I think what ties all of these things together is my own perspective of what seems to have been neglected, what seems to have been footnoted, or what seems not to have had as many storytellers and as many people talking about it as, you know, it ought to have.
Right. Now, you know, I believe that, you know, when we spend multiple years writing a book-length work, it does change us in some way or another in terms of whether it's our craft or how we look at our present world. And so I'm curious, is there any one thing about our current world, our present, where you find that having now written this book, your belief has changed about something in our current world? Is there anything like that?
I mean, to begin with, you know, I see so much happening on social media, people commenting on politics, etc. And simply having read so much and, you know, having spent so much time going through material from earlier times, on the one hand, of course, you recognize patterns and it's quite amusing because you're like, oh, wait, this is so similar to something that happened earlier. But the other thing is also, I don't know, I've realized that the world, I suppose people are so, everything moves so fast now and opinions come out so easily, etc. And, you know, I have this sense that it's all a bit immature. You know, things are so much more layered. Things are so much more nuanced and so much more complicated that it isn't. And simply because of reading history, you understand that it's far more complicated than social media solutions allows. There's certainly my perspective on a lot of contemporary political issues, the kind of issues bureaucrats deal with, even politicians deal with. We, you know, on social media, people can be very unkind sometimes about them and expect or at least say that, you know, this is how it should be. But in reality, in a country as complex as India, the kind of things people are dealing with when they're actually in politics or actually having to take certain decisions, history tells you that, okay, I don't think I would sympathize with them, but I would say I understand why, you know, things happen a certain way and why it's not easy to do the ideal thing or to do the thing that everybody else seems to think is right and therefore must be pushed. It's sometimes not easy to push at all. Sometimes if you want to push a little bit here, you have to give way somewhere else. And those intricate negotiations, what happens behind the scenes, I'm now, I think, much more attuned to that, much more attuned to what is not obvious. You know, with the princely states alone, you know, in the introductory chapter itself, I talk about this one Raja who, if one of our, you know, if by today's sort of trend, somebody were to look at his writings to the British, they'd say, oh my God, what a slavish man, you know, groveling and fawning and bowing and scraping. He basically talks about how India was a heap of stones till the British came and they're the ones who constructed the edifice. So completely a lackey of the Raj. But that's what he's saying in an official letter, in an official context to the Viceroy. The important thing is to look at what is happening behind the scenes. He's talking to other Rajas to thwart British plans. The British are describing him as disloyal. This man who's supposedly written a fawning letter is being described as disloyal, as somebody who's seditious, somebody who's, you know, notorious for the intrigues he's plotting against the British. So it's interesting that even at that time, things were far more complex than they appeared at the surface. And I think that's an interesting insight, I suppose, I've brought even to looking at the contemporary world. And
yeah, that, I mean, it's a useful totally insight. To your point about social media, for sure, you know, people react. So it's that knee-jerk reaction right away, yeah, without having all the facts, without, you know, because some of the complicated things that are unfolding, you know, at a national level or a political level, there's so much behind the scenes that it would take an investigative journalist days to go and figure out what the heck's going on. And yet somebody feels like it's totally fine to just write an incendiary tweet about it. You know, I totally get you. So I'm going to wrap up with, you know, two more questions, which are my usual. One is, what's next in terms of book projects? Can you talk about it, or, you know, what's coming next? Or and when are you going to get back to a weekly or a monthly column at all?
Well, I'm a bit of a superstitious person when it comes to writing, which is that till something is done, I don't talk about it. But at the moment, I can talk about one thing, which is that I'm currently finishing up my PhD. I have to finish writing my thesis in the next, well, it was 12 months, now it's about 10 months. And obviously, you know, the academic writing is rather slow. It takes a lot of time. And I've just finished this book. So it's going to require me, I'm going to have to really conjure up a lot of willpower and energy to sit down and start writing my thesis. But that's what's happening for the next year. I don't think I'm going to start writing a column anytime soon. I did do my Mint column for 3 years. And frankly, I took it as something of a training experience for myself, because I started it soon after I published my first book, which was a 700 pager. Each chapter could be up to 20,000, 21,000 words. And I just wanted to challenge myself and see if I could condense historical material into 1,000 words, you know, and not lose nuance, not lose the texture and the layers. Sometimes I succeeded, sometimes certain compromises had to be made, but it was an interesting challenge for me. And I did it for 3 years. And I'm very happy to say that I didn't miss a single week until I was specifically asked by them, you know, because they were doing some special features or whatever, and the columns were not being carried. So it was an interesting exercise, but it was also very stressful. Coming up with a fresh topic every week on history was not something. In the first couple of years, it came to me relatively easily. But then eventually I realized that it's a little bit of a challenge to have something original to say each week. And I don't want to bore readers. I don't want to do something too much and sort of, you know, end up in a situation where it's an overkill. So as of now, no plans. But who knows? I won't close the door completely on it.
Right. Well, okay. So the thesis, that's got to be a lot of work. So yeah, I totally get what you say about, okay, you're going to focus on that. Fair enough. And then, so my last question that I ask is, what's your favorite? And it doesn't necessarily have to be the single one favorite Desi book. It could be something you read recently that stayed with you. So what's your favorite Desi book and why?
I think in recent years, I've been evangelizing Benjamin's goat days, because it's not a very long book. It's a novel that's very short, very tight. It's about this immigrant from Kerala who goes to the Gulf, as so many do, except that his story turns into a complete nightmare and he's essentially enslaved in a desert with only goats around him. And, you know, it's such a moving story and so powerfully done. And it was recently translated, I think a year or a year and a half ago, into English. And it's a stunning, stunning book. And I sort of, every time somebody gets in touch with me, you know how people do all these book lists, right? Book lists are in some ways yes. a rather hopeless task, because how do you list the best books of a year? There are so many. It's ultimately very subjective. But every time I'm asked to sort of list my favorites, Goat Days is right up there. Another interesting book I read is by a World Bank economist called Shayana Bhattacharya, who I know from Delhi, except I knew her in her avatar as an economist. But she's now written a book called Desperately Seeking Shah Rukh, which is not yes. about Shah Rukh Khan, the film star, but about women across various classes, backgrounds, age groups in India, and how they, in some ways, their image of the ideal man is embodied in Shah Rukh Khan. So it's not really about the actor or the man, it's about how they construct Shah Rukh as a reflection of things they want to see in men, as a reflection of their negotiation in an unjust patriarchal world. And it's a very, very interesting book.
Yeah, so we're reviewing it. We're going to be reviewing that one. But to your point, that's an excellent literary device as well, because yes. she's taken this prism, and what she's giving us is a sociological narrative, right? Yes. But it's through this lens, or through this connecting thread of, yeah. you know, this imagined version of this huge Bollywood star. So yes. I think that's such
and there's a remarkable line in the book where she says that he's not a feminist icon, but he's a female icon. And it's such an interesting line. Mm. And the book is full of very many interesting insights of that kind.
Yeah. And like one insight I recall is, you know, where I think she asks somebody, you know, why do women love Shah Rukh Khan? And the answer was, women love Shah Rukh Khan because he loves women.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. yeah, and because they yes, and she talks about how, I mean, I don't know why, you should probably invite her on the podcast to talk about it, but I was again struck because, you know, there's this bit, and these were things I'd never noticed, but these women often say that, you know, he's the one hero, in quotes, who goes and helps women in the kitchen. He actually wants approval from the women in the movies, as opposed to the others who are all, you know, macho, and they're all, you know, these men. Whereas he's a much more emotionally interesting figure. So yes, that's another book I would recommend.
Great, great. Excellent book. Yeah, I could talk more about that because I've been reading it recently myself. And yeah, mm-hmm. I loved it too. Being a Bollywood fan, I expected something else, but then I was pleasantly surprised, I should say. I was pleasantly surprised and I loved the book. So thank you very much for that, Manu. And thank you for this very good, interesting conversation. I loved your book, False Allies, as I've loved most of your writing, you know, especially the columns, because I would wait for those to come out every weekend. I was in India during the time that you were writing your columns. So,
oh, good to know. I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, I was in India from like, I think mid 2014 till February 2020.
Oh, okay. So I wrote it from 2016 to the end of 2019. So yes, you were there.
Yeah. So, I mean, it came out every weekend. I would like wait for that, you know, for the whole Mint Lounge. That would be my thing. Because I love history too. And I think what I liked about it was what you did was you would kind of spark off a certain topic, if you like, and give us just enough that we would then want to go and dig deeper, right? And yeah. I think you and I kind of got into some of the, like when you wrote about some of the literary stuff, we would get into discussion.
Yes, I remember, yes.
Yeah, so thank you again. This was terrific.
Thank you. And
I look forward to sharing this podcast with all our listeners and readers. And I wish you all the very best with your thesis, because that's your next big thing right now on the docket. And hope to get more books from you and more interesting books from you.
Thank you, Jenny. And it was wonderful chatting. And I, you know, hope to return to the podcast at some point in the future, hopefully with a new book or something new to say.
Absolutely. I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 64 of Desi Books, news and views about Desi literature from the world over. I'm your host, Jenny Bhatt. Thank you for tuning in. Today's Desi Craft Chat was with Manu Pillai discussing his latest book, False Allies, India's Maharajas in the Age of Ravi Verma. Episode 65 will be up shortly. Follow on Twitter at Desi Books, Instagram at Desi.books, Facebook at Desi Books FB. Tag the accounts if you have requests or suggestions. And please go to the website if you'd like to sign up for the free weekly newsletter. That's at desibooks.co. And please share this interview via social media so we can keep raising the tide of Desi literature. Stay healthy, keep reading, and write well.